Hello and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Peter Suderman, filling in for Matt Welch, who got a lead on an incredible stash of Topps baseball cards from 1978. Just couldn't make it today. Today, I'm joined by my usual roundtable panelists, Catherine Mengu Ward and Nick Gillespie, as well as special guest Eric Boehm. Everyone say hello.
Howdy.
Hey.
Happy Monday, Peter.
Happy Monday, indeed. That's right. So today we're going to start with a segment we'll call Cop Out. Segment titles are sometimes silly, but this is serious. We are going to talk about police violence and what, if anything, we've learned since the police killing of George Floyd in 2020. As you may recall, Floyd's killing was captured on cell phone video by an onlooker. That video showed a white police officer fatally kneeling on Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes. Floyd's death sparked waves of protests, riots, and at times violence in cities during the pandemic summer of 2020, and it led to what was sometimes described as a national reckoning with systemic racism and police violence. Just this last weekend, another shocking video of police violence was released, this one showing the brutal beating of Tyre Nichols by five police officers in Memphis, Tennessee, earlier this month. Nichols screamed for his mother and did not appear to resist. He died in the hospital following the beating. The release of that video also sparked protests and outrage, but several things were different this time. First, video was taken from police body cams and it was released by the city. Second, unlike in the Floyd killing, all of the officers were black. The officers have already been fired and charged with second-degree murder, among other charges, and even organizations like the Fraternal Organization of Police, which has historically defended police officers, released a statement condemning the actions shown in the video. I will say, I read several descriptions of the video, but I was not able to watch all of the body cam footage. So before we really get the conversation going today, I just want to go around and ask you guys, did you watch all of the video? And if so, what was your reaction? Catherine, let's start with you.
I did watch it. I forced myself to watch it. I generally am not, I'm not a person who consumes information via video. I really prefer to read about things. I prefer to listen. But it seemed important to me to watch the whole thing. And, you know, this is a common feature of these videos, but it still was so striking in this one, the calling out for his mother. I know that a lot has been made of it. And in some ways, it, you know, it has almost already been cheapened or something. But listening to that, watching that in real time, I mean, my children have probably made me weak. That's what I hear parenting does to you. But it was excruciating, like just absolutely brutal. And I think that what it captures is this feeling of helplessness that people feel in those moments. And that I felt watching that video, that there is sort of an inevitability to this type of interaction. And once you are in it, there's nothing you can do or say to stop it from going where it's going to go. That was the overwhelming feeling that I had, which has definitely been reinforced by seeing more than one of these videos over the years.
Nick, did you watch the video?
Yeah, I always seek out these kinds of videos because I think it's important. You know, and that also included kind of terrorist violence, you know, things like the Daniel Pearl beheading thing, because it's one thing to read about them. It's another thing to see them. This one reminded me in a real sickening way of the Rodney King beating video from 1991, which kind of inaugurated this period that I think we're still in of where, you know, what might be called surveillance or, you know, which is surveillance, but from underneath or from distributed sources coming into play. And the thing that is worth taking away from it beyond some of the, you know, the kind of really deeply horrific emotional moments that Catherine was talking about is that you see in this, and this is also true in Rodney King, which again is kind of like an urtext for this, where the police have somebody who is completely incapacitated, who is not a threat to them, that they continue to beat. And that is, you know, that is where the line clearly gets crossed. And also, I think it's one of the places where the conversation about de-escalating violence in police encounters has, you know, the discussion of that was big for a while. It keeps going missing. this is the type of incident that really puts that, you know, I mean, it's banal to say, but it puts it front and center.
Yeah, I did watch the video. It is horrific. I could just repeat everything that Catherine and Nick already said. I guess the one thing I would add to it is that all the officers involved have been charged with second degree murder, and I think maybe charged with other things too. And after watching the video, that seems totally right to me. This was an incident in which, as Nick said, they continually escalated the violence, even though there was obviously no threat to them. I think anybody who watches this video, you know, there's no way to make the argument, as you sometimes hear from police defenders, of like, oh, you know, they have to make a split second decision and it's life or death and we can't judge. Like, they had many, many, many opportunities to stop doing what they were doing. And at every one of those moments, chose to keep doing the thing.
Right. And including so, the moment where they the shoe tie.
Yeah.
Like,
at one point, another officer like walks over and tries to like almost like moves one of the other cops out of the way and looks like he's almost like he's like trying to pull him away. Like, hey, you know, don't kick that guy anymore. And then the officer who has walked over to do that proceeds to then kick him three more times on the ground. And so it's, I mean, yeah, it's just like at every moment there were many opportunities here for different choices to be made. And they made the wrong choice at every one of those opportunities. And so, I think charging them all with murder is absolutely appropriate in this case, and I hope justice does what it does.
Yeah, and I think that's true even if you accept the initial version of the events, which said that the stop started as a reckless driving stop, right? Even if there was, you know, quite aggressive reckless driving in advance of this, there were opportunities to de-escalate while this was happening. Nick, actually, I just want to ask you here. This is obviously pretty awful. There's nothing to be happy about, really. But I do wonder if you see any signs of progress in the way this was handled. The officers were fired and charged pretty quickly after the assault, right? This was, I mean, less than a month here. The city released the footage, knowing it would be incendiary, in an effort to be transparent. Do you see anything to sort of say, well, at least this is being handled better than it has been in the past?
I think, and that might unfortunately be the limit of it, which is that, you know, the immediate response from the police establishment was to cast these guys into the fire. By the same token, you don't know how much of that is just cover your ass, because, you know, part of what any kind of investigation and any kind of trial is going to do is going to look at were these police acting in accordance or, you know, following police procedure as taught to them. You know, I know we're going to talk a little bit about the Scorpion group and everything, which, you know, is a kind of elite force within the Memphis police force, et cetera, and things like that. But because going back to Rodney King, that was a big part of the defense, is that at every moment, the cops who were beating Rodney King to, you know, a millimeter of his life were following the actual, you know, police procedures that they had been taught and had been, you know, so in fact, they were following. You know, exact. They were following orders and things like that, and that's a big question, because these instances are rare, and the question is how much do they reflect, you know, bad behavior by rogue cops, and how much are they, you know, exemplary or exemplifying what a system of punitive violence, you know, official punitive violence looks like. Another way to think about this is, so, you know, it's good that the police is not, and the city is not crouching, you know, is not in a defensive crouch, but they seem to be willing to actually open this up. In the year following George Floyd's murder, where again, the police hierarchy and the city were like, yeah, you know what, this is really awful. They did not pretend that this was, you know, standard operating procedure on that. There were something like 250 laws passed in the year after George Floyd's death, a lot having to do with certain, you know, banning chokeholds and things like that. Liz Nolan Brown at Reason Today has a piece up showing that most of the popular reforms that were kind of pushed or talked about in the wake of the Floyd killing would not have changed the outcome of this, because it's basically, you know, they didn't use chokeholds to beat him to death and things like that. The other thing where there is some small evidence of not of progress, but of change, is that cities like Portland, San Francisco, Denver, a number of other places have actually worked to remove police from enforcing traffic laws. But it also turns out that when you look at, you know, the police databases of deaths at the hands of police, stunningly few actually involve traffic stops. So, you know, and it's something like at Mapping Police Violence. In the last year, there were about 1,100 murders at the hands of police. Most of those justified, et cetera, but only 86 of them actually stem from traffic stops. So, you know, there's some progress, but not much. And, you know, I mean, I'd throw out there that the low number of about, you know, 1,000 police deaths a year, which has more or less been the case since about 2015, when these numbers started getting compiled in the wake of the Michael Brown death in Ferguson, Missouri. You know, that might be the lower limit when you're talking about literally, you know, millions of arrests a year, hundreds, probably hundreds of millions of encounters between police and citizens or residents. But so,
Catherine, historically, it has been difficult to go after cops who commit crimes on the job, in many cases because of specific legal protections and public sector employment issues. What do you see as the major obstacles that remain to punishing bad behavior by police, and what hopes, if any, do you have for reform?
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this weekend, that weirdly, the strides that we've made in checking police misbehavior have been, many of them have not had the intended effect, but still a positive effect. So I'm thinking here about body cams. You know, I really thought that there would be an observer effect, that by wearing body cameras, police officers would behave better. To know that you are being watched is to alter your behavior, and that surely the existence of the body cams would prevent misbehavior. There's not evidence that that has happened. There have been some really good studies looking into this question, and it's hard to know, right? Because, of course, we don't have camera evidence. We don't have video evidence from before they were wearing body cams at the same volume and the same quality.
We also don't have a counterfactual.
Right.
A world without body cams, we don't
absolutely
know what that would look
like. But I think, you know,
we do have a world with cell phones, which comes pretty close to, I mean, it really
but
helps.
I think if you had asked me, and I probably even wrote this, like, I would have assumed that there would be a substantial change in the kind of really, really egregious behavior. If you know you're on camera, why are you doing illegal stuff? Why are you doing, you know, why are you doing this sort of thing? That has not turned out to be true. And that instead, what the body cameras have done has been to provide evidence in he said, she saids, to provide a firm basis for prosecuting misbehavior, and also for exonerating innocent people who, you know, had evidence planted on them, that kind of thing. It's all after the fact. And so that is why I am tempted to say the only thing that matters is, well, two things. The only thing that matters in terms of a formal reform is to end qualified immunity. We are all broken records on this, but it's an after the fact thing, right? Like, it's when the bad thing already happened. And the question is just, what happens to the cops who did the bad thing? And I think the only way to change behavior in the long run is to have a deeply held belief on the part of police officers, on the part of law enforcement officers, that they will be held accountable. And that has to be through a longstanding, consistent enforcement in the courts. That's the only way. Because to just say, hey, you're not allowed to use this chokehold, I am very skeptical of that working. Of course, the other thing, which ties into what Nick was saying earlier, is just we need a world in which there are fewer interactions with police. And there are lots of ways to achieve that world. And that's a lot of what Reason Magazine does every day, is like, think of ways to write the rules so that people don't have to interact with police, except for when police will be a pretty clear net gain in the situation.
Eric Nichols is a Black man. And in this case, all of the police officers involved, all of the police officers who did the bad thing, were also Black. Some have noted that this adds some complexity to simple narratives about individual racism in policing. There's a piece in the New York Times that said that problems of race in policing are a function of an entrenched police culture of aggression and dehumanization of Black people more than of interpersonal racism. It is the system and the tactics that foster racism and violence, they say, rather than specific racial identities of the officers. Does the fact that all of the officers involved in this beating were Black change anything about the way we should understand the racial implications of police violence in general or of this specific incident?
I think it does change things a little bit, but maybe not in the obvious way. And I think, if anything, it actually narrows the focus here rather than adding complexity. So let me explain what I mean by that in a second. But first, I want to point out this, like, there was this CNN headline. This was a piece written by Van Jones over the weekend. And it just is worth mentioning here because the headline on it is "The police who killed Tyree Nichols were Black, period. But they might still have been driven by racism, period." That's the two sentence headline. And it's like, you're just really trying to jam that racism narrative in here no matter what. And I'm totally open to the idea that there is something sort of inherently, there is some sort of like white supremacist element to policing. And certainly there is historical, you know, evidence that that was the case, whether that still is, you know, I don't know. I'm open to that argument. But I think what this situation shows you is that this isn't really a racial problem, and that if addressing policing requires that we solve addressing the problems with policing requires that we solve racism, that becomes a much more difficult task. And so in some ways, that I think that is actually the more complicated lens through which to view this. What we learn from this incident in which five Black cops beat a Black man to death is that the problem is they were cops. There's something that New York Times bit that you just read there, Peter, is exactly right, that the problem here is something about the training and the lack of accountability that police officers, the training that they receive and the lack of accountability that they don't receive or that they don't expect to see on the back end when they engage in bad behavior. That crosses all racial lines. That's not a white thing or a Black thing. It's not a racism thing. But the clarifying thing here is, and I think the helpful thing here is, that we don't have to solve racism to fix these problems. We can address the problems with policing by, as Catherine was talking about, fixing qualified immunity. I think Liz Nolan Brown, in her piece this morning that Nick already mentioned, also points out how the massive differences between the way this was originally described, this incident, in the police press report, and what the actual footage shows. So we can learn from that. Media should learn from that, and general news consumers should learn from that, not to trust the police's first account of these types of incidents. And so there are things we can do in a much more specific and focused way that maybe have racial components to them in undoing some of these problems with police work in America. But, you know, it's actually much easier, I think, to solve these problems than it is to say, well, we have to fix structural racism on a, you know, societal level before we can expect police to behave better.
Since
this may even be, to follow up on that, this may actually be, you know, you don't want to say a blessing in disguise or anything like that, but to the extent that it actually focuses on police procedures, it can be a clarifying moment and a useful moment, because what happened almost immediately after George Floyd, and with the, you know, the way that Black Lives Matter and a couple of other groups started talking about structural racism, you know, and white supremacy and all of that kind of stuff, it really stopped reforms, like major reforms, from happening. Because I think ultimately it's a bad analysis. America has a white supremacist past in certain parts and things like that, but to call, you know, America in 2023 or in 2021 or whenever, you know, a white supremacist society, and that's the real problem. And, you know, these, you know, police murders are kind of rounding errors in that machinery of oppression, is not only alienating to most people, including most minorities, but it's just fundamentally false. So to the extent that this focuses on the way police actually act, why they're called into action, and what limits should be put on all of that, I think maybe we can get to a place to, you know, reduce the number of police murders that are unjustified to zero or something like that. I will point out, you know, and this, none of this is to, just wave this away or anything, but according to Mapping Police Violence, Memphis had 25 police killings between 2013 and 2021, 25 total, something like 289,000 arrests in that period. So this is also one of those questions where we are talking about extremely low numbers. And while the urge is always to make these the apotheosis of something, you know, in fact, that's also something that we both need to acknowledge and recognize. And the fact that this is, you know, a Black guy being killed by police, and Blacks are, you know, five times more likely to be killed by police than whites. You know, that matters, but that also is not the only, you know, it's not the only thing going on here.
So, Catherine, Eric brought up training, and Nick already noted that the officers who beat Nichols were all part of a special unit dubbed the Street Crimes Operation to Restore Peace in Our Neighborhoods Operation, which it turns out is an acronym for Scorpion. The Scorpion Unit was an elite squad of police officers who operated in small teams with less oversight than other cops. That squad has already been disbanded. In the New York Times, former Reason journalist Radley Balco has a pretty helpful op-ed looking at these units with a bit of history on a program from Detroit in the 1970s, the Stop the Robberies, Enjoy Safe Streets program, and that, of course, stood for stress. So, Catherine, what does that tell you about the promise or perils of policing based on scary-sounding acronyms?
I was going to say, first and foremost, it tells us, once again, the deepest principle of Reason Journalism, which is that if your thing has a cutesy acronym, it is a crappy authoritarian.
Not just the
overreach.
D.C. thing, actually. It's not just evil. The congressional thing.
Yeah.
Evil.
So that's worth getting out of the way. Yeah, I mean, I think that people sometimes confuse two problems. And one is, are police officers who are trying to do their jobs genuinely crippled by too much bureaucracy and too many stupid rules on what they can and can't do? I think they are. I think that is a true problem, and that anyone who is part of any large institution, doubly so if that large institution is the government, knows that that is true. There is a bunch of dumb stuff that cops have to do with their time that is not benefiting the community, is not doing any of the kind of core functions that we might expect out of police officers. And that's a problem. The solution is not no oversight or less oversight of particularly the officers that are out interacting with the community day to day. That's the wrong answer to a real problem. And so I am sympathetic when people say, like, how are cops supposed to do their jobs when they're, you know, have to do so much paperwork every time and have to, you know, their hands are tied in all these different ways. And it's like, yeah, I fully believe you that those systems are bad. But the answer is not create a bunch of like cowboys inside of a system with dumb rules that get selective exceptions to some of those rules. That takes us to this place. That takes us to, you know, not because, again, this was not one officer acting badly. This was a team of people who had been assembled, agreed on a series of norms, and then executed this like group action that was horrific, and that they all looked at each other doing it and said, this is right. This is us doing our jobs. So the culture that was created inside that unit and inside similar units in the past is clearly not what we want to be encouraging. Like I say, you don't have to convince me that government agencies are built inefficiently and are annoying to work for, and that like people can't do the parts of their jobs that they think are important. Absolutely, that's true. But this is not the solution.
All right. So speaking of dumb government bureaucracies with cultural problems, let's move to our next segment. It's only January, but the Treasury Department has already announced that America has hit the debt limit. So I'm going to call this segment Debt Men Tell No Tales. Hitting the debt limit is going to set up a showdown between President Biden, who wants to raise the debt limit with no concessions, and House Republicans, who want, well, some sort of spending cuts, maybe, and possibly to balance the budget within a decade, but without touching Social Security or Medicare. They haven't really clearly specified exactly which cuts they prefer. The closest thing they have done to being specific is that they've ruled out two programs from the cuts, Social Security and Medicare, after President Trump released, former President Trump released a short video urging Republicans not to cut old age entitlements. Several high profile Republicans said those programs were off limits. Over the weekend, Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy, who is the closest thing Republicans have to a leader in the debt limit negotiations, echoed that sentiment, saying that entitlement cuts should be taken off the table. So, Eric, going to start with you here. One of the arguments that critics of the Republicans in the House are making here is that House Republicans are demanding that the White House negotiate over spending cuts. But the House GOP does not appear to have a plan or a proposal that they can all rally behind. That makes it hard to negotiate since the other side doesn't even know what it is that Republicans want. And since Republicans haven't actually shown people what they want, it also means that the math doesn't really add up on, say, balancing the budget, which is at least something that has been raised by some of the Republicans in the House. So what do you think of that criticism of House Republicans? Are liberal critics of the House GOP right?
I think they have a point, and I think it's obviously that it's obvious that at the moment Republicans don't have a clear plan for balancing the budget or even a place that they're going to begin this negotiation at. But I think it's also a little bit unfair because we do have until June. There is a period of time here in which to develop a plan and to decide, from looking at polls of what your voters want and what your members in the House want, to kind of come up with a plan. I think and on that point, I think it's sort of hilarious that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said that we've hit the debt limit, but we're not going to actually tip over into crisis mode until June. It's like she's basically looked around the Treasury Department and assessed the size and depth of the couches in the Treasury Department. And she's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure we can find enough money in all these couches to keep paying the debt limit until June. We're in this extraordinary measures period. The whole thing is a bit concerning because we don't really know exactly when we're going to get into really serious territory here. Look, the bottom line in all of this is that the thing that Trump has said and that J.D. Vance and other Republicans have said in the wake of Trump releasing that video last week about not touching Social Security or Medicare is kind of a misnomer. Anybody who says we're not going to touch Social Security, we're not going to make any changes to Social Security, what they are really saying is there will be cuts to Social Security in a decade because Social Security will hit insolvency somewhere around 2034. And when that happens, benefit cuts will automatically be cut across the board by somewhere around 20%. We're not exactly sure what it'll look like, but that's one of the big Medicare trust funds. Yeah, there is no there's no world in which you don't touch Social Security or Medicare. And it just keeps functioning the way it is now forever. So the choice is cuts later or changes now. And that's, those are really the only two options here.
Or actually what's most likely happening is tax increases later to cover virtual everything. But, this is a replay of, things that were going on in the aughts. But last year, the federal government spent $6.3 trillion. It brought in $4.9 trillion. I think to start talking about balancing the budget in a decade and stuff like that is, and to say this or that is sacrosanct, is to play into the dumb Washington logic of this on the part of the Republicans. Surely they can come up with things to cut immediately so that we're not spending $6.2 trillion or $6.3 trillion again. Rand Paul, Tea Party Senator Rand Paul said they should start looking at the defense budget. That's a pretty good place to go. I would love to see, Republicans cobble together, let's say $500 billion. Half $1 trillion in spending cuts that they can throw right in front of people right now.
Yeah, how did we end in Iraq and Afghanistan and the defense budget went up? Explain that to me too, right? Yeah. The budget that at the very least should go down.
And I also want to point out, I don't know, Peter, if you agree with this, because you've written a lot about budgeting, as is Eric, and Catherine also weighs in too. But this is one of the good things about debt limit debates. We can argue whether or not they're legitimate, they're moral, they're effective, but at least they do present an opportunity to actually talk about spending at a time when very, very few people seem interested in it whatsoever.
All right, Catherine, I want to bring you in here with a special President Biden tweet reading.
I thought I'd have a break this week with Madoff.
Nope, we're going to do it. So just this Sunday, that's yesterday, Biden tweeted, Americans have paid into their Social Security and Medicare every single paycheck since they were 16 years old. I'm strengthening those programs. And if a piece of legislation lands on my desk that wants to gut them, I'll veto it. Go.
I mean, it's... That one doesn't actually get my, you know, raise the hairs on the back of my neck in the way that some...
It doesn't set off my malarkey detector,
but only because it's so bland, right? Like, this is the same oatmeal that we have been being served by politicians of both parties about entitlements generally, Social Security specifically, the imaginary savings account that's waiting for us, the lockbox, if you will, and also the idea that the two options are strengthen or gut, right? Like, why you gotta be like that, my guy? I know you're out here seeing the many, many, many shades of gray between strengthen and gut.
Would you say there are 50?
Yeah, I would say there are about 50. they're all just as unsavory as that book. I get it. But, you know, the sort of long fuse adjustments to expected benefits are not a gutting. They are a reasonable adjustment given the world that we live in. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, even I, your friendly neighborhood anarchist, doesn't think it would sort of meet the demands of fairness to end Social Security tomorrow. Just be like, sorry, jerks, no checks for you. Like, people have planned their lives around this. This is the same thing that we talk about a lot with regulatory uncertainty with respect to all kinds of like major decisions that businesses make, that individuals make. At the same time, it is entirely, wholly morally defensible to scale back some benefits. Absolutely it is. And in fact, when you, when you think about it in the bigger picture, it's required, because otherwise we are just punishing future generations. We are, you know, bringing about all the things that Eric described.
Where's the youth quake on this? Where, you know, you guys are younger than me. I'm starting to actually believe that I'm going to receive Social Security. I was always assuming that it would shut right before I was about to tap into it. But I mean, if you're under 45, why aren't you fucking in the streets over, you know, the ludicrousness of the idea that you're going to maintain Social Security?
No, I mean, I think Nick has said this just a few months ago, I think, on this same podcast about like how we're going to have this generational warfare is going to be like the theme of the next few years or something. And I think that's probably right. As we get closer and closer to this deadline, I think more people will become aware of just how screwed Social Security is for the long run. If you're younger than I'm 35 right now, I have very low expectations that I'll receive anything from Social Security. I would just like to, like, if the government just gave me back the taxes I'd paid into it right now, I would say, great, done. We won't even fight over interest. Just give me the principal that
we'll
I paid in.
We'll just pretend this never happened.
Pretend this never happened and we'll be done. And I'll be out forever. Like, good. I would take that deal. But that deal's not going to happen either, obviously.
Would you take no paying in any more?
Oh, I would want
here.
The money back.
And just walk away.
That I've already put in, at least. We would that would be a negotiation, obviously. But that negotiation isn't going to happen, because what's really going to happen here is the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to raise the cap on the payroll tax to make rich people pay more into Social Security, right? Which you can easily sell as we're going to make sure the rich pay more so that everybody gets benefits, blah, blah, blah. Easy enough. Then you're going to do some sort of means testing that will allow you to curtail benefits to the rich as well. And then that's going to, you know, be sold along the same sort of populist political lines. But even that, this is what Brian Riedel, who's a former Senate budget staffer and now a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and crunches all these numbers. So he's done this work. It's not just coming out of my brain. But, you know, those two things alone don't get you to where you need to go to fix this problem. So then you have to start looking at things that would be more politically difficult. You have to start looking at like increasing the payroll tax rate, which obviously hits all workers and people will be angry about that. You have to look at things like maybe some sort of VAT tax or something like that, just to shore up Social Security long. Like, there will be pain here for everyone. This is not a problem that you can get out of just by saying we will tax the rich and we will take away their Social Security, which is the first thing people will try to do.
I think the thing that stood out to me about that Biden tweet is that it plays into this very common idea that, you paid in and you earned it, and that therefore Social Security is yours, and that you have some sort of something like a legal claim to it, when in fact the opposite is true in two different ways. One is the amount that you are likely to get out. Most people will get out far more than they paid in, which is why there is a shortfall. If you pay in less than you get out, then that doesn't work over the long run. The other thing is that legally speaking, you have no right to that money. And so when the government takes it from you in tax form, they have absolutely no legal obligation to set it aside and make sure that you get it again at the end of your life. It is a transfer program from young to old, not a savings program. And the political rhetoric, even if it doesn't explicitly say this is a savings program and you have some legal right to this, it often sort of works from the implication or the assumption that people have that, oh, that's my money. It's not. The government took it from you, and now it is the government's money. And I think that drives a huge amount of misunderstanding about entitlements and about how they work. Okay, so we're gonna go to the next segment here, the reader question. But before that, we're gonna pay some bills with an advertisement. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. When you feel like yourself, you can do great things. But sometimes life is hard. You may feel overwhelmed. You may feel like you're in another room and you just can't quite hear yourself. Working with a therapist can get you closer to the best version of you. Because when you feel empowered, you're more prepared to take on everything life throws at you. Therapy can help. It can teach coping skills. It can empower you to take control of your feelings. It's for everyone in all walks of life. If you're thinking of giving therapy a try, BetterHelp is a great option. It's convenient, flexible, affordable, and entirely online. Just fill out a brief questionnaire, get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. If you want to live a more empowered life, therapy can get you there. Visit BetterHelp.com/roundtable today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/roundtable. All right, so this week's listener question is about legalizing drugs, and it comes from listener Griffin. We're going to call this segment Pulling the Drug Out from Under Us. Hello, Roundtable crew. Hello, Roundtable crew. I am a lawyer who represents clients in the cannabis industry. There is a prevailing thought that we can end the war on drugs by legalizing them. Well, okay, but this is wrong. This is wrong, says Griffin. Every state with legal cannabis has Byzantine regulations and licensing requirements that end up excluding people unless they have lots of money or get into bed with people who have lots of money. These people often open illegal businesses, and the government inevitably either continues enforcement against these illegal businesses or, as in the case of California, does virtually nothing and allows the illegal market to fester at the expense of all the folks who undertook the expense of getting licensed. Obviously, complete deregulation would eliminate enforcement altogether, but realistically, that's not going to happen. Given all of that, what does the Roundtable think the solution is to ending the war on drugs? Nick, let's start with you. What about the problem of, like, we are, if drugs are legalized, practically speaking, we are going to have some amount of taxation and regulation.
Yep.
And therefore, what do we do about that?
I don't know. Let's look to, the markets for selling beer, wine, and alcohol. And somehow, those manage to get by. You don't hear too many people complaining that they can't set up corner bodegas and sell beer in them and things like that. And the first thing to recognize, too, is, California has made a mess of marijuana legalization. Other states have done better, such as Colorado. New York is in the process of screwing up legalization royally. But the federal government has not done anything yet. So we still have a long way to go in that. And I would argue that if you actually descheduled or legalized marijuana at the national level and all of the implications of that, including banking, et cetera, we'd be working in a very different circumstance, which wouldn't be without problems, but there would be many fewer than there are right now.
Catherine, what do we do about the fact that even in a legal world, a world of legal drugs, there will still be regulations, still be taxes, and that will create incentives for black markets?
I thought Eric might like jump in here and start waving his arms around because he's written some really great stuff on how our tax and regulated markets for alcohol are pretty messed up, actually. Like, it's Nick is absolutely right to say the corner beer bodega situation is not the pressing issue, but I do think, you know, this is one reason that I worry about the, I think, quite defensively libertarian approach to, okay, you know, the minarchist approach in which you say, okay, we're going to have to fund the state somehow. We're going to have some kind of taxes. Let's do consumption taxes. And maybe even let's do consumption taxes where we use those taxes to nudge behavior. Because after all, we want to encourage good things and discourage bad things. And it's all fine as far as it goes, but it takes you straight to, oh, we have a pre-existing habitual black market in this thing. It's going to live on. It's going to, you know, carry all of the downsides of the black market into the world in which there is legalization. And, you know, I think that actually the parallel in many ways is opiates, right? Is pharmaceuticals, where those are legal, but they are so regulated, so aggressively policed that we have managed to create a new drug crisis out of nothing. And of course, for all of this, read Jacob Sullum, by trying to pull these levers of what we think people should and shouldn't do and what we think they should and shouldn't consume. So, yes.
I mean, in fact, very specifically, the last 25 years, we have seen increased regulation of opiates, and that has coincided with and arguably helped fuel the opioids crisis as synthetic versions that are much more dangerous for people have flooded the market.
Exactly.
Eric, how do you think about this question?
Yeah, I think about it in along the lines of like what happened after Prohibition, right? It's very similar. And there are states, there's a wide range of different rules that we exited Prohibition with, and states that had bad rules that were not very competitive and didn't allow for markets to operate as fully as they should for the sale of
Pennsylvania.
Right. I mean, Pennsylvania obviously is one of the famous examples.
But Mississippi didn't repeal Prohibition.
Right. Many,
until
many
the 60s.
States. And those rules, once they were put in place, whenever the repeal came along, those rules were then difficult to change. And in some cases lasted for decades, even though people were very aware of how bad they were. And so, yeah, sure. Use Pennsylvania as the famous example here, right? There were beer distributor licenses in Pennsylvania, and those things were incredibly valuable. They were so valuable that they created this own kind of like political economy to maintain this bizarre system where you couldn't buy six packs of beer. You had to buy cases of beer. And this is just one example of the many weird rules that Pennsylvania had. But the beer distributors, the people who had that small number of licenses, were for decades one of the most powerful and vocal groups in the state capitol against liberalizing the rules any further in Pennsylvania, because they didn't want the competition. They didn't want grocery stores to sell beer. They didn't want other places to be able to sell six packs and compete with them. And so you ended up with, I think, exactly what the questioner here is asking, which is like you end up with a government. It's not prohibition anymore. Obviously, it's better than that. But you end up with these government granted privileges that create their own kind of special interests that then perpetuate what is, better than a war on drugs or prohibition, but obviously not an ideal situation either.
The first time I ever got drunk was off of a case of Yingling yeah. purchased in Allegheny County, just outside of Pittsburgh.
My congratulations to you. My condolences to you. I'm not sure what the response to that is.
Yingling is the one of the best beers.
America's oldest brewer.
So I think people just really underrate. I totally take the point of this question. I think this is a good question for like how to think about legalization efforts. But I do think people misunderstand what prohibition did. What the end of prohibition did, I should say. The end of prohibition lifted the federal rules, but it left in place many, many, many quite restrictive state rules, some of which are still on the books or kind of the legacy of them is still on the books today and are still affecting how people can purchase alcohol. At the same time, the other thing that the end of prohibition did was it pretty much stopped gangs from murdering each other over alcohol. And this is this is to me, like, in some ways, the most important thing.
That's good.
Right? Like, I would really like there to be nice, orderly, minimally regulated markets for drugs. That would be great if people could make money off of this stuff. If we could, you know, have have some sort of safety regime where, like, you can, where this stuff is public, right? Where you can sort of get it in safe environments, all of that. But the main thing that I want is for gangs to stop shooting each other over drugs. And that happened a lot over alcohol during Prohibition for really obvious reasons. And basically, as soon as Prohibition was lifted, that ended. And that's what I want to see over. And that, like, even if what is left is a crappy, highly regulated market in which it's hard to sort of set up shop, in which the rules are difficult, in which there are still some illegal outposts, if what we can do is end the violence that is associated with the black market, then that's a huge step, and it's worth doing it, even if the next era, if the next phase of regulation is a total mess. Okay, so we have just a couple of minutes left here before we get to our recommendations, and I want to do a lightning round, a segment on arming Ukraine that I'm going to call "Tank You, Sir, May I Have Another?" The United States, Germany, the UK, other Western nations have said in the past month or so.
Can we call in an airstrike on Peter while he's
I like
making
it.
Up section
I don't head. Like it that I like it, but I like it.
So we're sending tanks to Ukraine to aid the war in Russia. And some reports also indicate that the Pentagon is under heavy pressure to start sending F-16 fighter jets as well. Let's do a lightning round around the panel. What's your reaction to the escalation of Western arms being supplied to Ukraine? Is this good, bad, complicated, or something else? Nick, let's start with you.
Yeah. It's complicated, and it's bad that we're doing it. I don't think this is the United States fight. We should support a free Ukraine, and we should not be sending, you know, tanks, planes, and advisors who are already entering the country, thereby setting up a possibility of us being fully embroiled
Eric?
In the war.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. It's complicated, skewing towards bad. I at some point, I think we're just in a war with Russia, and it's like that's a very uncomfortable situation to find yourself. So, you know, and I don't know who gets to make that decision. And NATO and the U.S. don't necessarily control the decision of when are we at war with Russia. Russia has a pretty big say in that, and you know.
The American government does, certainly,
well,
in Congress,
certainly.
Which doesn't seem to be really
right.
And
this is a
voting
good
for more funding for supplying arms.
Is that Congress should at some point either say we are at war with Russia and declare war on behalf of Ukraine, or Congress should say we are not at war with Russia and therefore we will, you know, draw some lines around what we are willing to do. And in the absence of that, it's a pretty fraught and kind of terrifying situation.
Catherine, tanks, F-16 fighter jets, what do you think?
I mean, I just want a world where there's a free and transparent market in fighter jets. Like, that's really the dream, you know? And I recognize that's a little bit flip. But also, you know, of course, in the world that we actually live in, it is inevitable that war-making machinery will be controlled and wielded by governments. But it needn't be, right? Like, there's a theoretical world in which the sale of a tank is a neutral commercial act. And if Ukraine can pay for tanks, they are welcome to buy them from us. And by us, I mean not the nation, which shouldn't be producing anything, but like tanks are us. I don't know who makes tanks. Like a thousand neocons just like wept in my, you know, my listens. Failing that, I agree with Nick and Eric that the danger to me is not will we overextend in any kind of particular moment, but that, you know, Eric's point that at some point, if Russia decides the things we did are war, they can decide that unilaterally. Like, I know we want Congress to Congress it up, but like, if they attack us, if Russia attacks the United States because it decides we are already at war, then we're at war. And I sure would not like that to be the case. As we have said many times on this podcast, the cause of the Ukrainians is just that doesn't make it our cause.
We live in a world in which I believe it was Congress or some regulatory agency decided that PlayStations, I can't remember whether it was the PS2 or the PS3, where I'm pretty sure it was the PS3, were actually so powerful that they constituted national security protected items and therefore could not be shipped to China or something like that. So I really feel like if we can't even deregulate and sort of take PlayStations out of the realm of national security, tanks and fighter jets are probably not going to be sold on the open market.
A girl can dream, can't she?
Yes, you can. Speaking of video games and video game systems, let's go to our final segment, what you been consuming, reading, watching, etc. Eric, let's start with you.
This is tough because I was going to talk about The Peripheral and Andor, both of which I just finally finished, but I see that people have already talked about them on this show. Peter has in both
you
cases.
You can talk about
so
shows that we
they're both wonderful. You
before.
Should watch them. Also, this is a reminder to people who are listening that you can check out reason.com/the Reason Roundtable recommendations to find like all the recommendations from all past episodes, which is helpful if you're not here every week and you don't know what people have talked about necessarily. So instead, I will mention an album that I was listening to this morning on the way here. That is fantastic. This is Kaylee Goldsworthy is the artist's name. She's like been in a number of bands or sort of like a touring musician with a bunch of punk bands that I'm a fan of. And now she's put out actually back in October, put out her first LP, Learning to Be Happy. And it's like it's sort of like if you like the rockier elements of Taylor Swift's Red album, which I am a huge fan of. And but you wish it was like it sounded a little bit more like Jimmy Eat World. That's kind of where she's at. She's a Philly musician. And anyway, it's a really cool album. I won't go on too long about it, but I think it's like an interesting thing to listen to. The I guess interesting political element to this is that for the first week, I think that it was out in October, she had 100% of the proceeds from her album went to Planned Parenthood. In protest of the Supreme Court decision last year. So for our listeners who are more on the pro-choice side of things, I think maybe there's another element there to listen to. I'll just recommend like two tracks. Losing My Mind and Overambitious are both really fantastic, like pop punky, but with like a little tinge of country kind of element to them as well. Cool stuff. Learning to Be Happy by Kaylee Goldsworthy.
I have not heard of her, but Taylor Swift meets Jimmy Eat World is possibly the most elder millennial thing I can imagine, just like in any realm. Nick, what do you have for us this week?
I read Daniel Akst's AKST, War by Other Means, The Pacifists of the Greatest Generation of Revolutionized Resistance. It's a incredibly rich history of the pacifist movement leading to a study of conscientious objectors during World War II. The main figures are David Dellinger, who ended up being part of the Chicago 7 trial, who was a CO during World War II, Dorothy Day, Dwight MacDonald, and Bayard Rustin, who was instrumental in the civil rights movement. This is an incredible alternative history. I mean, it's not a counterfactual or anything, but it's just something that doesn't get discussed very much. And among other things, it talks about how religion, organized religion in the interwar period and for a bit after, skewed left progressive in a way that's fascinating. But the push to kind of protest the draft in World War II is amazing. Because these are people who, to the extent that they had an economics, they tended to either be socialist or communalist in a way that is not, you know, certainly a post-war libertarian sensibility. But some of them, particularly Dorothy Day, who was big in the Catholic Worker movement and ran a publication with that title, called themselves libertarian because they were in favor of increased liberty and autonomy for individuals. So it really scrambles the categories of politics that we think about, post-World War II or looking backwards from today. So I highly recommend War by Other Means by Daniel Akst, who has written for a reason at various points and is a really excellent writer, great historian, and well worth
Catherine?
Reading. I unearthed a book from my Sundoku pile, which is a great Japanese word that we should all know, which is the books that you bought intending to read and then let pile up. It is William McCaskill's What We Owe the Future, which has been analyzed to death, including quite ably by Reason's own Ron Bailey in our pages. It is the case for long-termism, essentially. Now controversial, I don't know, effective altruist kind of approach to thinking about how much we should factor in future generations in our kind of moral calculus, in our day-to-day lives, in our public policy making. And despite having consumed a lot of commentary about this book, I found it to be better than I expected. And I had actually quite high expectations for it. So the kind of prose itself is wonderful, very, very readable, very appealing. When the book gets gimmicky, as it does in a couple places, there's pages upon pages of like little printed out stick figures to try and emphasize to you how many people are in the future compared with how many people are now, that kind of thing. The gimmick almost always lands. And
it's like the big splash page at the end of Watchmen when the squid monster finally takes over New York.
Just like that, except for with stick figures about moral calculations. But other than that, yes, exactly the same. Like, it is in fact like a philosophical treatment of the squid monster that is future generations and whether or not they should bring us together to, be better. And, I think as a matter of actual practice, the long-termists who are out here doing stuff, it's kind of collapsed unto itself, right? So the cool thing about effective altruism was like, let's be serious. Let's reckon with ourselves about the fact that a lot of what we think of as philanthropy is self-indulgent and not very effective, not very efficient. Let's try to eliminate some of that and do things that matter. The long-termist approach undid that, because then you just go back to your priors. Oh, I think climate change matters, so let's work on that. I think social justice matters, so let's work on that. I think, the path that AI takes is the only thing that matters, so let's work on that. But this book made me less snarkily judgmental about that approach. It made me more open to the idea that there are some genuine conclusions to be reached and not just a new, exciting way of justifying your priors. So William McCaskill's What We Owe the Future. I am not the first, nor will I be the last, to recommend this book. It has made the rounds, but it is quite good.
Catherine, thank you for bringing up monsters, the apocalypse, and being the last, because that makes a good segue for me to talk about the show I've been watching, The Last of Us, the new post-apocalyptic zombie series on HBO. It's based on a 2013 video game that is among the very best video games I have ever played. The series' third episode aired this weekend, and I have to say, it is a borderline masterpiece, an expansion and enrichment of a little plot point found in the game that just works wonderfully on screen and really hit me pretty hard as I watched it last night. This particular episode stars the great Nick Offerman as an anti-government, paranoid, conspiracy-obsessed, survivalist, gun-nut, bearded guy living in a homemade suburban bunker where I assume he also has a complete collection of issues of Reason magazine. So he's like set up traps and surveillance around his house to fend off raiders, infected zombie types. And one day he catches another guy in the trap. Importantly, another middle-aged bearded guy. But instead of killing him or sending him on his way, he invites this other guy into his home for a meal. And then, over time, they fall in love. And they live out a complete life over decades in their little suburban bunker home with its American flag and their guns and their good wine and their arguments about like how many guns they really need and whether it's appropriate to believe that the government is actually a bunch of authoritarian Nazis or not, which in the show, they definitely really kind of are. And as they live their lives, the zombie apocalypse just sort of proceeds around them. It's incredibly ambitious, incredibly moving, and it reminded me a little bit of one of the all-time great episodes of genre TV, The Inner Light from Star Trek The Next Generation, where Picard lives a complete life in the memory of a dying civilization. It's just small and specific and well-observed and deeply humane, and to my mind, it is the first truly great TV or film project I have seen in 2023. Strongly recommend it. That's The Last of Us, airing now on HBO. Before we go, Nick, I just want to ask you, do you have anything to share, to tease, to preview for our listeners?
Yeah, a week from today, on Monday, February 6th, we have a Reason Speakeasy, a live taping of the Reason Interview podcast in Midtown Manhattan. The guest is Kat Rosenfield, whose new mystery novel is out, You Must Remember This, which Catherine talked up a couple of weeks ago and is fantastic. She's also going to be talking about some of the pieces that she wrote for Reason about things like cultural appropriation or silencing oneself in the face of kind of woke or politically correct attacks on same. You can go to reason.com/events to get details. Tickets are $10. That includes beer, wine, soda, and food. The Reason Speakeasy on Monday, February 6th.
All right, that's it for this week. Remember that if you like what you hear, you can support us at reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you for listening, everyone. The Roundtable will return in Thunderball.